Some of you may have seen the series on PBS by Ken Burns on the national parks. Anybody seen that series? Yeah, well, I took the title. I stole the title from the title they had for episode one, which they called The Scripture of Nature. And it focused on what we're going to talk about tonight. I have just a little bit of the material from that was pertinent and useful. But then the Lord seemed to, as I was working towards last fall's assignment, seemed to be directing me to learn more about this subject than I ever knew. And my former employees, I used to work for the National Park Service, and my former employees invited me to host a workshop session at a conference last August, and it was by the speaker was a man by the name of Mark Stoll, and he wrote this book, Inherit the Holy Mountains, Religion and the Rise of American Environmentalism. And I got to, well, I was thought, you know, if I were a host of a talk show on TV or in the radio and you had a guest, you better well have read his book so you can, you know, talk intelligently with him. And so I got the book and read it, and I was just truly amazed at what I learned. And much of the material tonight came from that. And then, at about the same time, lo and behold, the current issue of Christian History Magazine comes, and it's on the wonders of creation. And lots of great material came out of there, too. So those are my sources, and as I say, between the various assignments and things that kept funneling my way, it seemed that the Lord was perhaps blessing a presentation on this subject. So for centuries and ages, mankind has been in awe of the natural world around them. When they have taken the time to notice the small intricacies of living things and the majestic scenery of large landscapes. In Psalm 19, which we sort of just kind of musically sang a bit of, David wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they display knowledge. There is no knowledge or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world." Augustine of Hippo, commonly known as St. Augustine, lived from 354 to 430 A.D. And this is what he wrote. "Some people, in order to discover God, read books. But there is a great book, the very appearance of created things. Look about you. Look below you. Note it. Read it. God, whom you want to discover, never wrote that book with ink. Instead, he set it before your eyes, the things that he had made. Can you ask for a louder voice than that? Why, heaven and earth shout to you, God made me." A man known as Hugh of St. Victor, a Saxon theologian who lived from 1096 to 1141 and became the head of the school at the Abbey of St. Victor in Paris, wrote, "This whole visible world is a book written by the finger of God." Martin Luther said, "God writes the gospel not in the Bible alone, but also on trees and in the flowers and clouds and stars." Now, my parents took the family camping whenever there was vacation time. Maybe yours did too. I grew to love the outdoors and nature. And on one of those family vacations in 1962, when I was 12 years old, my parents took us out west to visit many of the national parks. And I decided then and there that I wanted to work for the Park Service, and eventually I found myself doing so, which I found to be a great blessing. But I remember my early disappointment in the scenery of Nebraska when in 1981 my job with the National Park Service moved Janice and I from Ann Arbor, Michigan to Omaha, Nebraska. Having grown up in Michigan with its extensive forests and many lakes and streams, I was disheartened by the relative lack of those things in Nebraska and the surrounding region. I could tell you vivid stories about that. That is, that was my feeling until I was assigned to work on establishing the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, following the route of their famous expedition. And I began to read the journals of Lewis and Clark. Now, William Clark was a rather pragmatic in his descriptions of what they did and what they saw, but Meriwether Lewis would wax poetic in his enrapturing descriptions of the scenery and wildlife and plant life. It was not until I was able to see the lands they traversed through his eyes that I began to appreciate the beauty of the prairies and high plains and mountaintops through and the mountains through which they passed. This is an excerpt from Lewis's journal on May 31st, 1805. The hills and river cliffs which we pass today exhibit a most romantic appearance. The bluffs of the river rise to the height of from 200 to 300 feet and in most places nearly perpendicular. They are formed of remarkable white sandstone, which is sufficiently soft to give way readily to the impression of water. The water in the course of time and descending from those hills and plains on either side of the river has trickled down the soft sand cliffs and worn it into 1,000 grotesque figures, which, with the help of a little imagination and an oblique view at a distance, are made to represent elegant ranges of lofty freestone buildings, having their parapets and stocked with statuary. Columns of various sculpture, both grooved and plain, are also seen supporting long galleries in front of those buildings. As we passed on, it seemed as if those scenes of visionary enchantment would never have an end. 2 weeks later, on June 13th, 1805, this is what he wrote. I had proceeded on about 2 miles when my ears were saluted with the agreeable sound of a fall of water, a roaring too tremendous to be mistaken for any cause short of the great falls of the Missouri. I wished that I might be enabled to give to the enlightened world some just idea of this truly magnificent and sublimely grand object, which has, from the commencement of time, been concealed from the view of civilized man. Of course, they were very familiar to the native inhabitants of the area. But reading those words, I came to appreciate the beauty of those areas. Now, of course, Lewis and Clark and their men were experiencing these lands in near pristine condition. But much of the beauty and wonder still remains today, despite human modifications to the landscape. And it is specifically for the purpose of preserving unspoiled remnants of those landscapes that the United States began setting aside lands as national parks. The first national park set aside was Yellowstone in 1872. Others followed in this order. Mackinac Island, Michigan in 1875. Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks in 1890. Mount Rainier in 1899. Crater Lake in 1902. Glacier in 1910. And Rocky Mountain in 1915. But there was no agency to take care of those places until the National Park Service was created in 1916. So last year marked the 100th anniversary of the creation of the National Park Service. Now the legislation creating the National Park Service said that the purpose of setting aside and managing these parks is, quote, we all had to memorize this, but I've been retired a few years, so I'm going to read it. We all had to know our mission statement. To conserve the scenery and the natural and historic objects and the wildlife therein, and to provide for the enjoyment of the same in such manner and by such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. National parks, open to the enjoyment of everyone, was a totally new idea. It was something America introduced to the world and is frequently referred to, as in Ken Burns' presentation, as America's best idea. If you explore the stories and histories of those who worked to preserve these landscapes and the plant and animal life that inhabit them, we learn that they were motivated by their understanding of what these places communicate to us about God the Creator, about the character and power of God. While today it is a popular notion that Christianity is opposed to conservation and environmental protection, the truth is that the National Parks Movement and the larger conservation and environmental movement in America was begun by people who were motivated by a desire to honor God, the Creator. Those who worked to preserve these special places found their inspiration in two references from God, two books of Scripture, the Bible and the natural creation in which we dwell, with the revelations it contains about the nature, character, and power of God, the Creator. God's written revelation points to this second book by way of the Apostle Paul. In Romans 1:19-20, for what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. When we think of national parks, those of us that have worked so closely with them, we often think of John Muir. How many people know who John Muir was? That's good. He is known as the father of the national park system, not only for his campaign to protect Yosemite Valley, but his continued campaign to have other parks created and cared for in a manner that protects their natural and scenic values. John Muir was born in Scotland, in the house at the extreme left of the picture. He was born in Scotland in 1838. In 1849, at age 11, his family emigrated to the United States and settled in Wisconsin. John loved to spend time in the marshes and sedge meadows that were on their farm. His love of the natural world began here and heightened when he studied botany at the University of Wisconsin. In America, the Muir family joined the Disciples of Christ congregation of the Restoration Movement begun by Thomas and Alexander Campbell. John's father, Daniel, sometimes served as the minister of their local church. He believed that anything that distracted from Bible study was frivolous. He required his children to memorize Scripture. Consequently, by an early age, John Muir could recite more than half of the Old Testament and all of the New Testament from memory. His religious upbringing and his love of all things nature merged to result in rhapsodic praise and admiration for the Creator of all things. John found the natural beauty of the Sierra Mountains in California to be the grandest cathedrals in which to worship God. And I think I'm one slide behind there. Well, as I said, he went to the University of Wisconsin and studied botany. And reflecting on his studies in botany, he wrote, "Like everybody else, I was always fond of flowers, attracted by their external beauty and purity. Now my eyes were open to their inner beauty, all alike revealing the glorious traces of the thoughts of God and leading on into the infinite cosmos." In March 1867, when he was 28, Muir had an accident that changed his perspective on life and the world around him. He was working building wagon wheels at a shop, and a tool he was using slipped and struck him in the eye. He was confined to a darkened room for 6 weeks and wondered if he would ever regain his sight. His sight did return, and the experience changed the way he saw his purpose in life. He later wrote, "This affliction has driven me to the sweet fields. God has to nearly kill us sometimes to teach us lessons." Any of us relate to that? From that point on, he determined to be true to himself and to follow his dream of exploration and study of plants. He began a wandering walk down to Florida. Once there, he caught a ship to Cuba and then New York, and then he booked passage on a ship to San Francisco, arriving there on March 28, 1868. He headed for Yosemite Valley and spent the months of April, May, and June there. In 1869, he spent the summer shepherding sheep in the high country up in Tuolumne Meadows in the High Sierras. He began hiking, climbing, and studying nature in the Sierras. When he left the high meadows at the end of the summer, he descended into Yosemite Valley. It was, Muir wrote, by far the grandest of all special temples of nature I was ever permitted to enter. As he explored the valley and surrounding area, he later recorded, I drifted from rock to rock, from grove to grove. When I discovered a new plant, I sat down beside it for a minute, or a day, to make its acquaintance and hear what it had to tell me. I asked the boulders I met whence they came and whither they were going. In everything he saw, Muir believed he was witnessing the work and presence of God. Heaven knows, he wrote, that John the Baptist was not more eager to get all his fellow sinners into the Jordan than I to baptize all of mine in the beauty of God's mountains. In 1870, Muir wintered in Yosemite. One day, hiking in deep snow to a ridgeline in hopes of seeing an avalanche, he instead became part of one. Somehow, Muir survived being swept several thousand feet down a canyon on a cascade of snow and ice. He described his experience as the most spiritual and exhilarating of all the modes of motion I have ever experienced. Elijah's flight in a chariot of fire could hardly have been more gloriously exciting. I was one slide behind again. Anyway, there's the words. Well, this was the beginning of John Muir's lifelong dedication to saving and preserving Yosemite and other superlative landscapes for all people to enjoy. His motivation was based on his reverence for God in the creation. He considered these landscapes to be the most sacred temples or cathedrals in which to worship God. In 1871, Ralph Waldo Emerson came to Yosemite to be guided through it by Muir, who he had heard about. He encouraged Muir to give up his reclusive life in Yosemite to teach and write. Oh, these vast, calm, measureless mountain days, Muir wrote, inciting at once to work and rest, days in whose light everything seems equally divine, opening a thousand windows to show us God. In a very momentous date, in 1874, the Overland Monthly magazine began publishing a series of articles by John Muir entitled Studies in the Sierras. Almost sounds like Studies in the Scriptures. Anyway, I thought that was fascinating, the interplay of... In 1890, Muir and others were successful in getting Congress to set aside 1,500 square miles as Yosemite National Park. But the West was being settled and tamed. Muir was concerned. He began advocating for more parks. In 1903, President Roosevelt visited Muir in Yosemite and toured and camped with him for 3 days. On the third night, with President Roosevelt as his captive audience, Muir made a plea for Yosemite wilderness and for setting aside other areas in the United States for park purposes. Muir's main focus was not only the need for forest preservation, but also his concern that the California State grant of Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove of the Big Trees, that they be ceded back to the United States for inclusion in the park. He was afraid that those large trees were going to be cut by timber people. In 1906, this resulted in a joint resolution that accepted the recession by the state of California of Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias, withdrawing them from state protection and putting them under federal protection as part of the park. He also began advocating for a government agency to administer the parks. John Muir died on Christmas Eve, 1914. 2 years later, the National Park Service was created. Here is what he wrote that was used by Ken Burns to open his PBS series on the National Parks, America's Best Idea. And if you've seen the program, you'll perhaps recall these, read by a wonderful Scottish accent person. One learns that the world, though made, is yet being made, that this is the morning of creation, that mountains long conceived are now being born, brought to light by the glaciers, channels traced for rivers, basins hollowed for lakes. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. The whole universe in unity and interrelation is alive and familiar. The very stones seem talkative, sympathetic, brotherly. Everybody needs beauty as well as bread, places to play in, and places to pray in, where nature may heal and cheer and give strength to body and soul alike. This natural beauty is made manifest in our magnificent national parks, nature's sublime wonderlands, the admiration and joy of the world. But John Muir was not the first person in the modern era to think of the natural world as a revelation of the Creator. In early 1836, American painter Thomas Cole was desperate to create a painting for the annual April exhibition of the National Academy of Design, of which he was a founding member, and he had nothing yet to contribute to the exhibition. He decided to paint a landscape which he had sketched in pencil several years before. Now, he had made his reputation and living as a painter of landscapes, but in his own mind he was first and foremost a religious painter. He dreamed of the day he could stop painting landscapes and paint just religious scenes like this. Some of his religious paintings are Christ crowned with thorns and mock, Hagar in the wilderness, and the angels appearing to the shepherds, and this one, the Garden of Eden. But the landscape that Thomas Cole produced for the exhibition, which he formally entitled View from Mount Holyoke, Northampton, Massachusetts After a Thunderstorm, and is more popularly called the Oxbow, was a sensation, having such an effect on the artistic world that it launched what has become known as the Hudson River School of Landscape Painters. He went on in 1836, the American Monthly magazine published an article by Cole entitled Essay on American Scenery, in which he laid out his perspectives on how essential the preservation of wild scenery is to the well-being of mankind, and how important it is for his fellow landscape painters to reveal the eternal's glory hidden in nature to their materialistic countrymen. In his essay, he affirmed the world's purpose. It has not been in vain. The good, the enlightened of all ages and nations have found pleasure and consolation in the beauty of the rural earth. Prophets of old retired into the solitude of nature to wait the inspiration from heaven. It was on Mount Horeb that Elijah witnessed the mighty wind, the earthquake, and the fire, and heard the still small voice. That voice is yet heard among the mountains. St. John preached in the desert. The wilderness is yet a fitting place to speak to God. He who looks on the nature of a loving eye and gazing on the pure creations of the Almighty feels a calm religious tone steal through his mind, and when he is turned to mingle with his fellow men, the chords of which have been struck in that sweet communion cease not to vibrate. Those scenes of solitude from which the hand of nature has never been lifted affect the mind with a more deep-toned emotion than aught which the hand of man has touched. Amid them, the consequent associations are of God, the Creator. They are his undefiled works, and the mind is cast into the contemplation of eternal things. Nature has spread for us a rich and delightful banquet. Shall we turn from it? We are still in Eden. The wall that shuts us out of the garden is our own ignorance and folly. May we at times turn from the ordinary pursuits of life to the pure enjoyment of rural nature, which is in the soul like a fountain of cool waters to the wayworn traveler. And let us learn the laws by which the Eternal doth sublime and sanctify his works, that we may see the hidden glory veiled from vulgar eyes. Like nearly everyone else raised in New England, Thomas Cole was raised in a congregational church community. With its Calvinist roots, one might think that the austere teachings of John Calvin would have taught him to disregard the things of earth and focus on the things of heaven. But in painting the oxbow, Thomas Cole inserted into his landscape religious elements pointing to the awesomeness of God as creator. And this perspective was not at variance with what John Calvin taught. In his Institutes of the Christian Religion, John Calvin wrote that we know the most perfect way of seeking God is for us to contemplate him in his works, whereby he rendered himself near and familiar to us, and in some manner communicates himself. In writing a preface to a French translation of the New Testament prepared by his cousin, Calvin stated, "It is evident that all creatures, from those in the firmament to those in the center of the earth, are able to act as witnesses and messengers of his glory to all men, to draw them to seek God, and after having found him, to meditate upon him and to render him the homage befitting his dignity as so good, so mighty, so wise a Lord who is eternal. Yea, they are even capable of aiding every man wherever he is in this quest. For the little birds that sing, sing of God. The beasts clamor for him. The elements dread him. The mountains echo him. The fountains and flowing waters cast their glances at him, and the grass and flowers laugh before him." An early Calvinist creed, the Belgic Confession of 1561, declared, "We know God by two means. First, by the creation, preservation, and government of the universe, which is before our eyes as a most elegant book, wherein all creatures, great and small, are so many creatures, characters leading us to contemplate the invisible things of God, namely his eternal power and Godhead or divine nature, as the Apostle Paul says, and secondly, by his holy and divine word." So there he saw that same connection from Paul in Romans 1:20. Even the iconic Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards, and his most famous sermon, it's called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. not someone I would want to have preached to me, but even someone like that saw God's glory in the natural world and drew inspiration from it. He said, "God's excellency, his wisdom, his purity and love seem to appear in everything, in the sun, moon, and stars, in the clouds and blue sky, in the grass, flowers, trees, in the water, and all nature, which used greatly to fix my mind. I often used to sit and view the moon for a long time, and so in daytime spent much time in viewing the clouds and skies, to behold the sweet glory of God in these things, in the meantime singing forth with a low voice my contemplations of the Creator and Redeemer." And sometimes you wonder, how can you hold one without the other, you know, the view. But they'll be ready, they'll all be ready to hear the good news when it's finally put forth. And they'll recognize it because they'll recognize it as validating what they saw in his creation. In the middle of the 17th century, clergy were researching and writing about natural science. English Puritan minister John Ray wrote many scientific books, including in 1691 a book entitled The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation. In 1802, Anglican minister William Paley published a book entitled Natural Theology, or Evidence of the Existing and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature. And in this book, it goes on, and it was amazing that all of these early natural science books were written by members of the clergy. They were the ones who saw it clearly at first. Fascinating. The Calvinist tradition also placed high value. Let me just mention the slide I got up here. This was just taken a couple days ago when we were visiting. I couldn't believe it, that there used to be a redwood forest in Colorado. If you told me before I saw that petrified stump, I wouldn't have believed it. But the things to be discovered are just amazing, and I was delighted to see the pasque flowers growing nearby, named because they bloom at Passover time. The Calvinist tradition also placed high value on stewardship of all that one has possessed. In his commentaries on Genesis, he stated, "Let him who possesses a field so partake of its yearly fruits that he may not suffer the ground to be injured by his negligence, but let him endeavor to hand it down to posterity as he received it, or even better cultivated. Let everyone regard himself as the steward of God in all things which he possesses." Wonderful sentiment. This echoes the passage in Leviticus 25:23. This is from today's English version. "Your land must not be sold on a permanent basis because you do not own it. It belongs to God, and you are like foreigners who are allowed to make use of it." Sister Brenda, that's the point we were talking about at lunch today. As the seeds of conservation movement were sprouting in the Calvinist congregational church and town meeting culture of New England, landscape painters did their part to illustrate God's handiwork and fire the imaginations of the people. Those who explored the expanding frontiers of the nation took landscape painters with them, painters like Albert Bierstadt and Thomas Moran, gave the American people a glimpse of the amazing natural grandeur that lay west of the Mississippi. Early leaders in the conservation movement were New Englanders, brought up in the congregational churches and learning the Calvinist values of reverence for the creation and stewardship of all that God has given us. George Perkins Marsh, who wrote Man and Nature in 1864, Frederick Billings, and Frederick Law Olmsted all came from New England towns. These men and others of their generation formulated a powerful conservation ideology for agricultural improvement, forest conservation, and parks, and vigorously worked to realize their vision of a righteous, moral, and democratic society. Olmsted became the foremost landscape architect and park planner of his day. In 1850, he set sail for Old England and an intended walking tour of England and Scotland to make notes on agricultural practices for articles in the Horticulturalist magazine. However, after disembarking in Liverpool, he was directed to visit a new public park in Birkenhead, the first park anywhere in the world that had been developed with public funds. He was fascinated with its playgrounds, winding paths, little lakes, and the presences of people of all ages and classes. He reported, "5 minutes of admiration and a few more spent in studying the manner in which art has been employed to obtain from nature so much beauty, and I was ready to admit that in democratic America there was nothing to be thought of as comparable with this people's garden." 7 years later, in 1857, without any previous experience or training, Olmsted found himself as the landscape architect for New York Central Park. In the plan produced for the park, Olmsted and his associate, Calvert Vaugh, consciously translated the Hudson River School painters' principles into an actual landscape. Through New Englanders like Olmsted, the landscape values emanating from New England towns and churches manifested themselves in state and national parks. When Yosemite was set aside as a California state park in 1864, Olmsted was named as the head of the Yosemite Commission. Sarah Jane Clark Lippincott, who was the great-granddaughter of preacher Jonathan Edwards, an editor of the children's magazine, The Little Pilgrim, wrote an account of the pilgrimage she and fellow travelers made in 1872 to the sacred Sierras. Yosemite, she wrote, was the temple of nature's ancient worship, with thunderous cataracts for organs, and silver cascades for choirs, and wreathing clouds of spray for perpetual incense, and rocks 3,000 feet high for altars. Connecticut Valley Congregationalists continued to lead the American Parks Movement. Ferdinand Hayden and Cornelius Hedges of Westfield, Massachusetts, were the principal proponents of Yellowstone National Park, established by Congress in 1872. George Bird Grinnell, a Yale graduate and grandson of Massachusetts Congregational Minister, led the creation of Glacier National Park. Stephen Ting Mather, a deeply religious man and descendant of several Congregational ministers, was the driving force behind the creation of the National Park Service, picking up where John Muir had left off. And the principal author of the bill passed by Congress in 1916, that I read you the excerpt from earlier, that created it, was the son of Frederick Law Olmsted, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. Well, that's kind of the history part of this, and how the people who were, just some of the people who were involved and motivated by their reverence for God, led this movement to create these things, to preserve them, and to work for their beautification. But now, let's ask the question. What does the natural world reveal to us about God? I think each person answers this question for him or herself. I think the expressions I have shared from various people reflected their individually personal experience with the natural creation around them. So I'm going to take a few minutes to share what the book of nature, the scripture of nature, communicates to me about our Creator. To me, the natural world reveals God's love, care, and provision for us and all of His creatures. God's love for His creatures is shown that in forming the earth, He provided in it everything that His creatures would need to sustain life, develop, grow, and enjoy. Earth teems with life, sustained by very complex systems that provide light, air, heat, water, and food, and all in an exquisite balance. And if you ever haven't seen a prairie dog stand up like that and chirp, you should see it sometime. The creation shows evidence of having been specially built to accommodate living things comfortably, like a magnificent house. Let's consider light and heat. Among the many precise conditions vital to life on Earth is the amount of light and heat energy received from the sun. The Earth gets only a small fraction of the sun's energy, yet it is just the right amount required to sustain life. This is because the Earth is just the right distance from the sun, an average of 93 million miles. As it orbits the sun once a year, the Earth travels at a speed of about 66,000 miles per hour, and that speed is just right to offset the gravitational pull of the sun and keep the Earth at the proper distance. In addition, the Earth consistently makes a complete rotation on its axis every 24 hours. This provides regular periods of light and darkness. Well, what if the Earth rotated on its axis, say, only once a year? And there is a planet that does that. Which one is it? Does anybody know? I didn't have it down here. One of the planets in our solar system revolves only once a year, so the same side is always facing the sun. Anyway, maybe it's the red planet. I don't know. Anyway, but if the Earth did that, it would mean that the same side would be facing the sun all year, and it would become a furnace-like desert, while the other side would become a sub-zero wasteland. Nothing really that we know of in terms of life could exist in those extreme conditions. But what about the atmosphere? The atmosphere also factors into maintaining the balance of radiant heat received and stored from the sun. But the atmosphere has many beautiful properties designed into it. It has the perfect balance of gases. Too much oxygen would be toxic to us. Lightning causes the nitrogen in the air to form compounds with oxygen that then fertilize our soil when it becomes to the earth in rain. The ozone layer, which isn't what it used to be, but the ozone layer filters out harmful radiation from the sun. The atmosphere shields the earth from meteors. Generally, they burn up as they pass through the atmosphere. And the atmosphere insulates the earth, retaining warmth and protecting us from the cold of space. It has a lot of functions built into it. When was the last time you thought about all these purposes which the atmosphere plays, and about how carefully God prepared our earthly habitation? Most of us appreciate the atmosphere on a daily basis by its beauty. It provides beautiful sunrises and sunsets and cloud patterns, moonlit nights, starry skies. So God not only made it functional, but he made it beautiful, a thing to be admired and enjoy. Think for a moment about the mansions that are being prepared for the faithful overcomers of this age. Can you imagine how marvelously they are being prepared? Think about what a blessing the perfected earth will be to the restored human race in the kingdom, and how it will bring forth praise and reverence for the Creator. Let's consider water for a moment. It is truly amazing. It's the most abundant substance on earth and has many properties that are essential for life. To me, its most amazing property is that it occurs as a solid, liquid, and gas, all within Earth's normal temperature range. Think of what this has meant to the technological progress of civilization in terms of water power and transportation, steam power, food preservation, and so forth. Water will dissolve more substances than any other liquid. All living things are dependent on it to dissolve the substances on which plants feed. Water is also extraordinary in the way that it freezes. As water in lakes and seas cool, it becomes heavier and sinks. This forces the lighter, warmer water to rise to the top, which is nice for swimming in the summer, you know. Yet as water approaches the freezing point, the process reverses. The colder water now becomes lighter and rises. When it freezes into ice, it floats. The ice acts as an insulator and keeps the deeper waters underneath from freezing, thus protecting marine life through the winter time. Without this unique quality, every winter more and more ice would sink to the bottom, where the sun's rays could not melt it in the following summer. Soon much of the water in rivers, lakes, and oceans would become solid ice. All marine life would perish. The earth would turn into an icy planet that would be inhospitable to all life. This speaks loudly to me about intelligent design of a creator. To me, the natural world around us proclaims God's love, care, and provision for his human creation and all other living parts of his creation. How perfectly he prepared it. Parents, think of how well you would design and build a house for your son or daughter and their family to live in, if resources to do it were not an object. How much care and love would you put into it? Another clear message that the natural world declares very clearly is that the creation had a creator. Did all of these bountiful provisions just happen by some chance miracle? Maybe I'll back up for a moment. The natural world also teaches that there are natural consequences for both good and bad decisions and actions. God has designed the world so that there is a system of checks and balances called natural consequences. It works in the physical world as well as in human society. Sometimes things appear to be a bit out of balance, generally because man, through his ingenuity, manages to delay or temporarily avert the natural consequences of his actions. But there comes a time when the consequences cannot be denied their lawful operation. There is a justice to this system. The system of natural consequences teaches, or should teach, discipline, accepting the reality of the way things work and working with, rather than against, the laws of the universe. Again, both in the natural and the human context. By having a system that operates by laws, God has designed mankind's habitation in a way that is a self-teaching system, teaching by experience. Natural consequences are occurring in the earth today, human activity is adversely affecting Earth's natural systems, overloading them beyond their ability to cleanse and restore themselves. Ignorance and greed have led to water pollution, air pollution, toxic chemicals in the food chain. While advances were made in this country in the 1960s and 70s to regulate human activity and improve the quality of the environment, political forces today are arrayed to roll back regulations designed to protect our air and our water. Consequences will result. There is no denying it. Even within the human family, natural consequences should teach us the better ways of living, because hatred breeds hatred, but forgiving leads to forgiving. Kindness breeds kindness, and love produces loving responses. The Bible also testifies that there are natural consequences to human behavior. Galatians 6:7 says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, this he will also reap." Mark Twain wrote about with great sarcasm about futile efforts by men to try and control the Mississippi River. We've all lived, most of us, long enough to know about the floods that hit every so often, the devastating floods. The river follows the laws of gravity and nature, and not the wishes of men. This is what Mark Twain wrote, talking about the predecessor the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and its predecessor, the U.S. River Commission. He says, "The military engineers of the United States River Commission have taken it upon their shoulders the job of making the Mississippi River over again, a job transcended in size by only the original job of creating it. They are building wing dams here and there to deflect the current, and dikes to confine it in a narrower bounds, and other dikes to make it stay there. And for unnumbered miles along the Mississippi, they are felling the timber front for 50 yards back with the purpose of shaving the bank down to low water mark with the slant of a house roof and ballasting it with stones. And in many places they have protected the wasting shores with rows of pile." One who knows the Mississippi will probably aver, not aloud but to himself, that 10,000 river commissions with the minds of the world at their back cannot tame that lawless stream, cannot curb it or confine it, cannot say to it, "Go here or go there," and make it obey, cannot save a shore which it has sentenced, cannot bar its path with an obstruction which it will not tear down, dance over, and laugh at. But a discreet man will not put these things into spoken words, for the West Point engineers have not their superiors anywhere. They know all that can be known of their abstruse science, and so, since they conceive that they can fetter and handcuff that river and boss him, it is but wisdom for the unscientific man to keep still, lie low, and wait till they do it. Captain Eads, with his jetties, has done a work at the mouth of the Mississippi River which seemed clearly impossible. So we do not feel full confidence now to prophesy against like impossibilities. Otherwise, one would pipe out and say, the commission might as well bully the comets in their courses and undertake to make them behave as to try to bully the Mississippi into right and reasonable conduct. I love that. So you had to indulge me. But trying to work against the forces of nature. Another thing that our world displays is the magnitude of God and his love for order and organization. Our Milky Way galaxy contains over 100 billion stars. The diameter of our galaxy spans so vast a distance that if you could travel as fast as the speed of light, it would take you 100,000 years to cross just our galaxy. Our Milky Way galaxy is 600 quadrillion miles in diameter. The average distance between stars within the galaxy is said to be about 36 trillion miles. So many galaxies have now been detected that it has been said that they are about as common as blades of grass in a meadow. About 10 billion galaxies are in the observable universe. These awesome galaxies are not scattered haphazardly in space. Instead, they are usually arranged in definite groups called clusters, like grapes in a bunch. The Milky Way galaxy, for example, is part of a cluster of about 20 galaxies. There is even evidence that the clusters themselves are arranged in superclusters, like bunches of grapes on a vine. Consider the order of our solar system. The planets move about the sun with such precision that astronomers can accurately predict where they will be at any time in the future. Our entire experience in life teaches us that everything organized must have an organizer. And consider the magnitude of God in some of the smallest features of his creation. Photosynthesis occurring in green plants is astounding because it takes place in tiny cell bodies called chloroplasts, and they are so small that 400,000 chloroplast cells could fit on the period at the end of the sentence on this paper. And within these chloroplasts, there are about 70 separate chemical reactions that must take place in succession in the process of photosynthesis. Everything works together in the right order to produce the basic organic building blocks of our world. Did it just happen? Just start happening? Or did someone design it? What do you think? How about God's appreciation for the beauty of variety and diversity? Why is there more than one kind of tree, one kind of bird, one kind of fish? The natural and human creation teaches us that God appreciates variety and diversity. One of the wise benefits of having a wide variety of plants and animals with differing growth patterns and resource requirements is that it assures survival of life after natural catastrophes. The variety of plants and animals made necessary a variety of environments and ecosystems, and vice versa. Would we wish the whole land surface to be a desert? How about forested? Mountainous? We appreciate the beauty of God's creation because of this variety, including the diversity in the human family. God has also arranged for diversity in the church. He develops each member in a unique social environment. Variety leads to balance, harmony, and beauty. We had here the scripture from Ephesians 4, but that was read earlier today in the study on unity. So we'll go on to another point. The natural world shows God's appreciation of his creatures working together for the common good. In the natural creation, we recognize what is known as symbiosis, the intimate living together of two dissimilar organisms in a mutually beneficial relationship. Certain plants and animals need each other to exist. In this example on the screen, stinging ants live in the hollow thorns of acacia trees. They keep leaf-eating insects off the tree, and they cut up and kill vines that try to climb up on the tree. The tree secretes a sugary fluid that the ants relish, and it also produces small false fruit, which serves as a food source for the ants. We might ask, did the ant first protect the tree and then the tree rewarded it with the fruit? Or did the tree make a fruit for the ant and then the ant thanked it by protecting the tree? Did it all chance to happen together at once? I think it loudly displays the intelligence of a grand designer. And then in general, we understand the relationship between insects and the pollination of plants. The natural world teaches me that God values partnerships, working together, helping one another. God intends it to work that way in the church as well. 2 Corinthians 1, 3 and 4. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. Okay, let's conclude with one final story. The influence of one life upon another is wonderfully demonstrated in the story that led to the establishment of Rocky Mountain National Park. Enos Mills was born in Kansas in 1870. At the age of 14, he left his family and moved to Colorado, establishing a homestead near Long's Peak, south of Estes Park. The next year, at age 15, he climbed Long's Peak, 14,255 feet tall, climbed it by himself at age 15. And during his life, he climbed the mountain by himself 40 times and nearly 300 times guiding others. In 1899, he was in San Francisco, and he had a chance encounter with John Muir on a San Francisco beach. It changed the direction of his life. He dedicated himself to campaigning for the protection of outstanding natural landscapes, writing and lecturing to build public support, just as Ralph Waldo Emerson had advised John Muir earlier. His speeches focused on the life cycle of trees, forestry practices, the lives of wildlife, and the preservation of natural lands. In his speeches and writings, he encouraged people of all ages to get outside to appreciate the natural world. Enos Mills was the driving force behind the effort to persuade Congress to establish Rocky Mountain National Park in 1950, and he is known as the father of the park. One of his notable statements is, "Without parks and outdoor life, all that is best in civilization will be smothered. To save ourselves, to prevent our perishing, to enable us to live at our best and happiest, parks are necessary. Within parks, national parks is room, glorious room, room in which to find ourselves, in which to think and hope, to dream and plan, to rest and resolve." Henry David Thoreau expressed similar thoughts when he wrote, "We need the tonic of wildness, to wade sometimes in the marshes where the bittern and the meadow hen lurk, to smell the whispering sedge where only some wilder and more solitary fowl builds her nest, and the mink crawls with its belly close to the ground. We can never have enough of nature, and wildness is the preservation of the world." I think the energizing thing about the stories of those who had a role in launching the conservation and wilderness preservation efforts in America is their acknowledgement of the sacred and divine in those places, their continuing sense of wonderment and excitement over the mysteries yet to be discovered and understood, placed there by their creator. John Muir expressed it this way, "I used to envy the father of our race, dwelling as he did in contact with the new-made fields and plants of Eden, but I do so no more, because I have discovered that I also live in creation's dawn. The morning stars still sing together, and the world, not yet half-made, becomes more beautiful every day." John Wesley, founder of the Methodist denomination, made an interesting observation about God's love for variety and diversity in the creation, and his reflection on it, on what is yet to be revealed about the future of God's plan. This is what he wrote. "If there be 8,000 species of insects, who is able to inform us of what use 7,000 of them are? If there are 4,000 species of fishes, who can tell us of what use are more than 3,000 of them? Consider how little we know of even present designs of God, and then you will not wonder that we know still less of what he designs to do in the new heavens and the new earth." Brethren, God has opened to our understanding his intended purposes for mankind's future and the general designs of his worldwide kingdom of righteousness and peace under the kingship of his Son, Jesus Christ. We can read his purposes and designs in the book of Scripture, and we can read it in his book of nature. Both of these inspire us to greater faithfulness and devotion. May both of these inspire us to greater faithfulness and devotion in the days yet ahead in our lives here on earth. And may the Lord add his blessing to these considerations.